Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Daryl Paul with us. He's professor of political science at Williams College, where he has been since, is it 2001, Daryl?
That's right.
Okay, PhD in University of Minnesota. Although you said a while back you were born in California, right?
It's true. I was born in Northern California, lived a couple years in Southern California, but moved to Minnesota in elementary school. So I consider myself a Minnesotan at heart.
Okay. I've come to believe that, living on the East Coast or the West Coast, first of all, those two places are quite different from one another, but everything in between is different too. And sometimes in our internet age, we underestimate regional differences, regionalism. You know, conservatism might mean one thing out in Arizona. It means something quite different up in Pennsylvania. So maybe that will come into play here. But Professor Paul is a prolific scholar, a writer. I'll mention a couple of things. There's Rescaling International Political Economy, a book he wrote, published in 2005. He wrote an article for us that got very good response in the August 2018 issue entitled Culture War as Class War, How Gay Rights Reinforce Elite Power. And I think some of the material from that essay found its way into a book that came out just a few months ago. This is from University of Baylor, Baylor University Press, and it is called From Tolerance to Equality, How Elites Brought America to Same-Sex Marriage. So welcome, Daryl.
Thanks very much, Mark. I'm glad to be here.
Okay, I'm going to get right to one of the core issues that you bring up early on in the book that may confuse a lot of people. Many people may not have understood something here. You document how enormous the change regarding homosexuality and same-sex marriage was and how quickly it happened early in the book. And you have polling numbers to show how opinion has changed. But there's one factor in the change that a lot of people might overlook. And that is that if you believe that the same-sex marriage issue, being a progressivist kind of thing, that might have emerged and been led by a marginal population, homosexuals in America, activists, that wouldn't really quite be the story. And I'm going to read a whole paragraph. This is from the end of the introduction, and then I'll let you go with where you want to take this. Existing accounts of this change emphasize the role of activists in the process of moral growth so much that the contributions of corporate America, normalization's most powerful ally, are invisible. Normalization being your term for LGBT rights being not a marginal concern or a big minority concern, but actually LGBT rights aren't even really different. They're just like heterosexual rights, everyone else's rights. That's the normalization process. But the corporate contributions of corporate America are invisible. Perhaps this is because the movement for normalization and same-sex marriage understands itself and is understood by others as a force for the political left. Some have even been so bold as to call it, quote, the civil rights movement of our time. It begs explanation, then, how a supposedly left-wing movement became the cause célèbre of the country's rich and powerful. Support for normalization, after all, has always been positively correlated with income and level of education. Big businesses' endorsement should be especially puzzling. Corporations marketing directly to the public are usually highly sensitive to public opinion. They tend to follow, not lead, the herd when it comes to controversial social issues. Yet in this case, corporate support came well before public support. This is a puzzle that cries out for a solution. An answer to the question of how and why elites brought America to same-sex marriage. That's the end of the introduction, and the book answers the question. But we're here to have you begin to answer the question for our listeners right now.
I think, Mark, you captured what was really one of the central interests of mine in writing this book, that same-sex marriage, particularly in the 90s, really even into much of the 2000s, was depicted as a progressive movement. It was depicted as a movement for marginalized people to come into the mainstream. It was depicted as something that was challenging to the establishment. And yet when I looked around, I saw more or less all the establishment figures, or at least a great majority of them, and growing always in time, being supporters of this. And so that's one of the characteristics, if you will, the political dimensions that really caught my attention and caught my eye, and that made me really want to try to explain this, because I didn't think anybody else had done as sufficient a job as I had hoped in doing that. There have been works in this field on the role of activists and the role of judges, and I think those are important parts of the story. But what I was particularly interested in is how this became a mass phenomenon, especially among millions and millions of what I call in the book elites, or if you want to use the term professionals and managers. They're really, I think, the ones who drove the same-sex marriage and normalization as a mass phenomenon.
You know, I'm going to give you an anecdote that when I first encountered this, this was way back in about 1999, 2000. I was at Emory University at the time, and the president of Emory University, who had been an English professor in his former life. He was an English professor from Stanford. He'd gone into administration. I think he'd become a provost there. Then he became the president of Wesleyan University, and then he moved to Emory. And Emory has a Methodist background. It started as a Methodist college back in 1836. And there's a very nice Methodist chapel there. And out of nowhere, right out of his office, for no apparent reason that one could see outside, he was pushing for gay couples to be able to use the chapel for same-sex marriages. The Methodist Church didn't want this at the time. And it seemed a battle that nobody was picking except him. And you're wondering, okay, you're the president of a university. You've got issues of budgets and alumni and recruitment and the hospital issues. Buildings have to be created, and this is something that you have chosen, and it's taking up a lot of your time, and it's producing controversy that, as far as anyone else knew, did not exist. Is this the case? Is this an example of what you're talking about?
Well, I think the example that you bring up, Mark, is an interesting one, particularly in the kind of religious or denominational sense. So one of the things I talk about in the book is the spread of normalization throughout the social classes, in particular professionals and managers. But one of the things that I trace in one of the chapters of the book is how religious organizations, right, Christian and Jewish denominations, picked up normalization. And essentially, what I show in the book is that the more professionals and managers you have, the richer your members and the more highly educated they are, the more the earlier and the more likely they are to embrace normalization and same-sex marriage. So the Methodists are an interesting case because they have resisted. But the main reason why Methodists have resisted is because of their polity. That is, Methodists have a global polity. That is, African Methodists and Asian Methodists, as well as American Methodists, all make the rules and the decisions for the entire Methodist Church. And as your listeners may know, African and Asian Methodists are not on board same-sex marriage, even if many of their American fellows are. So I think this is where kind of this class dimension comes into religious denominations. But to kind of give a broader answer to your observation, this is part of what I call a diversity ideology. Diversity really has captured the imagination and really all of the thinking processes of elites in the United States. And this has been going on for a while, but certainly I think in the 90s and the 2000s, it really crystallized. And gay men and lesbians hold a really special status in diversity ideology. They're particular symbols of success. And it doesn't hurt that lots of gay men and lesbians are already well integrated into the elite. And so I use a phrase in the book, and I call it diversity without tears. elites can have lots of the benefits of seeming very magnanimous and also in exercising and practicing their ideology without really giving up anything in terms of their material interests.
Right, right, right. You know, you say, this is on page 49, where you're talking about social class and the progress of normalization. Social classes are not simply defined by their capital or their relationship to the labor market. They are just as much defined by cultural practices and attitudes around language, art, leisure, and food. Now, and as well as sexuality, marriage, and family, you say. Did the elite then assign homosexuals, not just the fact that homosexuals might be overrepresented in the elite, they're certainly overrepresented in academia, in my experience, but that homosexuals become a marker. They're a site toward which you can relate yourself to mark your own status. They become instrumental to your own social class, your own membership in the elite.
I think that's right, and this is why. This is why at least the handful of people on the left who have actually listened to my argument find something really interesting in it. That is, that I think gay rights organizations, gay men and lesbians, have been important actors in this movement, for sure. But since they're such a small part of the population, there has to be some kind of connection to the mass appeal, particularly the mass appeal among elites, which are, you know, tens and tens of millions of people in the United States. And that symbolic quality of homosexuality being tied to images of success, if you doubt it, just look at the kinds of advertising that hotels and travel agencies and alcohol distributors use gays and lesbians to market their products and give a feeling of success and luxury and leisure. But also because I think the quality of the closet and coming out that's so associated with homosexuality in the United States links gays and lesbians up to these themes of authenticity and individuality. And corporations and elites in general love that stuff too. So gays and lesbians become a great symbol for them to embody lots of the cultural values that they already have.
And as symbolic affirmations of those values, if you don't affirm them too, you're in trouble.
It's interesting how, I mean, this is kind of captured in the title of the book, right, From Tolerance to Equality, that when same-sex marriage in particular was touch and go, it wasn't clear whether it was going to sweep the country as it eventually did, the pro-normalization people, both kind of activists as well as, you know, newspapers and other kinds of elite opinion outlets, really use this language of toleration. That you really need to be tolerant of these other expressions of sexual orientation and to allow people into an institution that they want to join, they don't want to transform. And this was very much the language. But as soon as same-sex marriage began winning, not just here in Massachusetts where I am, but especially in some of the bigger states like in New York or at least for a time, right, in California, the language began switching to equality. That is, gays and lesbians are just the same as straight people are, and that because equality is such a powerful value in terms of kind of emotions and the way it taps into so much of kind of the larger history of the United States, that if you challenge that, now you are denying people's equality. And that's a dangerous thing to do in America. And this allows the movement for same-sex marriage to be linked into the movement for civil rights and to kind of adopt a lot of the iconography and a lot of the history of civil rights for blacks into this newer movement.
And so this is why when you have a case like Brendan Eich, he had to go down. Even though, I mean, maybe you should rehearse the Brendan Eich case for our listeners.
So the Brendan Eich case is particularly interesting. So Brendan Eich is one of the creators of the Firefox web browser and one of the founders of Mozilla Corporation, which is the, I'm not sure exactly the kind of legal status of Mozilla, but it's kind of like a cooperative nonprofit sort of endeavor. This is kind of the ethos of Mozilla. So anyway, Brendan Eich was extremely accomplished. He was one of the chief officers in Mozilla. And when he was named the CEO of the corporation back in, I can't remember the year off the top of my head, early 2010s, it came out that Brendan Eich had donated a rather small amount of money, a couple hundred dollars, I believe, to the pro Proposition 8 interest groups in California around the proposition in 2008, which would overturn the Supreme Court ruling, the California Supreme Court ruling, and return to recognizing only opposite-sex marriage in California. So this was already known for a few years when Eich was kind of promoted to the position he did have before he became named the CEO, but it just blew up in a firestorm. And this is something that Eich's closest associates at Mozilla didn't even know about him. He kept this so quiet. It was so under the radar. He didn't campaign for, or sorry, he didn't campaign against same-sex marriage.
There was absolutely no evidence that he had ever discriminated against LGBT.
No, indeed. The only way anybody knew about his views on homosexuality or same-sex marriage is when the Los Angeles Times got hold of the donor list to the pro Prop 8 interest groups. And so his name happened to turn up on it. That was the only piece of evidence. But that in and of itself was enough so that both his employees at Mozilla, as well as the entire tech community up in Silicon Valley, as well as sort of the broader kind of internet voices, just came down him on him like a ton of bricks. He lasted, I don't even think, a week after it became quite broadly known that he had contributed some money to that cause. And so he resigned.
Errol, why not just ignore it? I mean, that he's not doing anything against gays and lesbians in the workplace. He gave a small donation to a proposition that was overturned, right, in Obergefell. So why not just ignore it and move on?
Well, in fact, that's what I tried to do at first. He defended himself and said, there's no history of me ever discriminating against gays and lesbians here at Mozilla, and give me a chance to show you how I really do believe in equality. And it wasn't enough. Ultimately, it was the people around Eich who told him, you've got to go. I think if he would have dug in his heels and refused to have quit, they would have removed him forcibly. And so he felt like for his own interests, as well as for the interests of the corporation that he really helped found, it was best for him to go.
Well, what we see there then is that this normalization process raises the stakes to purity, right? We've got to get rid of everyone, or at least have a few high-profile expulsions that will set a precedent. People will take notice, and we'll see. This is how it works.
Yeah, I think that because this is the normalization has become so hegemonic in the elites of the United States among professionals and managers, that there's smaller and smaller room for dissent from normalization. One might say that, you know, same-sex marriage is the law of the land, and so I certainly think that there is very, very low likelihood that that's going to be overturned anytime in the near future. But of course, there are other kinds of battles, sort of religious freedom sorts of battles that social conservatives are keen to try to pursue. And even those, right, are more and more difficult to do. And so I think if you look particularly at the kind of hardest edge of normalization in the professional class, for example, psychiatry and psychology and social work, you see it in the law field as well. I think it's becoming increasingly difficult to be a social conservative and to exist, not just to sort of do your job well, but to even do your job, period, in those fields.
Well, I'm just not sure, and this has stuck with me over the last few years. Why did the activists, why did people who work at Mozilla, why did they react so strongly to Ike? I remember reading one of his tweets or something, where it was after he'd left a year later or so, and he was still being criticized, and he responded to one tweet by saying, "I'm sitting at home without a job." Okay? I mean, how much vilification should he receive? It just seems that there's a very dark side to normalization of things that previously were understood as abnormal. And that this is not a spread of tolerance, that there's a lot more going on, especially if you're a social or a religious conservative.
I think there's two things going on that I'd highlight in response to your question, Mark. The first is the analogy to racism. I think you see so many things analogized to racism, and really just the definition of racism expanding continually in the United States. And racism really is, I think, in the United States today, the unforgivable sin. If you are successfully tagged as being a racist, I don't think there's really recovery from that. And so there's certainly a political interest in expanding the definition, but also expanding the analogy. And so I think people feel extremely passionately about things that are analogous, at least in their view, to racism. And certainly opposition to normalization is that thing. It is, in many people's minds, analogous to racism. And the second, I would say, is something that is peculiar to professionals. And I think when I say professionals, I don't just mean, say, people like myself, college professors, and yourself, but also, you know, people in law, people in medicine, but also people in corporations, but that have professional-like jobs, say, people in Silicon Valley or people in the banking sector. And professionals in America today are people who believe, in my view at least, that speech is louder than action. That is, words speak louder than deeds. Of course, the old aphorism is that actions speak louder than words. Mm-hmm. But among a class of people who, most of what we do, professionals, is we talk and we use words, words are the most important thing. And so I think they're less interested in what Brendan Eich or, say, Mark Regnerus, another professor at the University of Texas, who I discuss in my book a little bit as well, what they did. What matters much more, far more, is what they say. And the policing of speech is much more important to them than the policing of actions.
Your conclusion is entitled "The Revolution Beyond Tolerance." What is that going to be?
I talk a little bit about religious freedom and the efforts of conservatives to kind of pursue religious freedom legislation, and why I think a lot of that is fraught. And then I talk a little bit, and rather briefly, in the final chapter about what comes next. And I think a lot of people kind of ask that of themselves. Well, now that homosexuality has become normalized, what's next? And I think it's pretty clearly, from the vantage point of 2019, transgender identities and transgender ideology.
You say at one point, transgenderism is not simply another useful stick with which to beat religious conservatives. Although that's one thing it can do.
Yes, I think that's right. And that's one of the reasons why I think elites embraced normalization. not the only reason, certainly, but one of the reasons was I think it's politically useful.
Mm-hmm. You also call it transgenderism, and this I've never quite heard this before. Transgenderism is the most radical form of individualism.
I guess I'd encourage your listeners to think of it this way. If I say I am a thing, then I am that thing. Right, we've come to the point, for example, in the state of New York, right next door to Massachusetts, where I am. The legislation now is that one can simply make a declaration of one's sex, and one doesn't need any kind of note from a doctor or any kind of medical confirmation of a surgical procedure or anything. One simply says, I am a man, I am a woman. And this strikes me as a really radical form of subjectivity, that I am whatever I say I am, and you need to accept it. That strikes me as individualism in really its most radical form.
But you're seeing, in your final pages, you anticipate, well, you've seen already, some anti-elite reaction that you implicitly tie to these elite demands that most people are really starting to feel the strain of following. And so you say the rapid normalization of transgenderism among elites is a symptom of a larger crisis. Elites are failing to exercise authority. So paradoxically, the way the elites are pushing these particular kinds of efforts, at the same time, they are losing their broad authority. You note that the evidence is all around. Confidence in all institutions, whether the state, the professions, or big business, drags along near 40-year lows. And you end up saying that the 2016 election was in part a reaction against a revolt against the elites.
I think that's right. So let's take the first part of what you read out of the end of my book. I think that homosexuality became normalized successfully in part because of strong support from professionals, psychology and psychiatry and social work in particular, but also law. And these are the fields that I talk about at some extent in the book. They led the way towards normalization. But with transgenderism, these fields have followed. Transgenderism made demands of psychiatry and psychology and social work, and they've kind of rushed to catch up. And so this is what I have in the kind of the background of what I mean by the diminishment of elite authority. We don't believe things because elites tell us to believe them. We believe things, and then elites are trying to rush to catch up and say, oh, well, we endorse this too. So please continue to listen to us. But I think that's evidence that people are less and less listening to elites, particularly mental health elites. One can just look at the American Psychological Association's recent guidelines on treatment of men and attacking very traditional forms of masculinity as toxic to see another good example of that.
Right.
So we have that that dimension. But then we have the sort of wider backlash, which I certainly do not want to suggest that the election of Donald Trump or Brexit or the success of Le Pen in France, the French presidential election 2 years ago, is really driven by social conservatives. It's not. But I think it's symptomatic of this wider erosion of elite authority. And then what we wind up with are societies where elites rule, but they rule because they have power. That is, they can use their power against others to make the society the way they want. They don't get the legitimacy from the masses. And the masses, as the old phrase goes, are revolting. And you see it not just in the US and Britain, but you see all throughout Europe. You even begin to see it in places that were supposedly immune to this kind of thing. You see it in a Sweden, you see it in a Canada.
I'm gonna read your last paragraph in the book now, because you mentioned Brexit, the election of Donald Trump, and you say, perhaps the Brexit supporter and the Trump voter truly are deplorable. Perhaps both Britain's departure from the European Union and 4 years of Donald Trump in the White House will prove to be as disastrous as elites predict. Nemesis is not a constructive force. It avenges and punishes. Yet, by chastening excessive pride, it also restores balance between mankind and the gods. Anything to add to that, Daryl?
Well,
that's a nice ending.
I did. I hope for a poetic and maybe in a backhanded way, sort of hopeful ending that, let me put it this way, every society is ruled by its elites. One really can't have a society where everyone is equal in terms of the power that they exercise, the prestige that they're awarded, et cetera, et cetera. But we can have meaningful and positive connections between the elites and the masses. And I think that's what so many people, not just conservatives, right? Lots of liberals as well are very concerned about how elites and the masses are diverging in so many different ways. Life outcomes, success in the kind of new globalized high-tech economy, things like mortality rates. We see all kinds of divergences. And I hope that the divergence will come to an end and that elites can use their skills and practice their authority in ways that actually benefit the masses rather than persecute them.
The book, I'll say again, From Tolerance to Equality, How Elites Brought America to Same-Sex Marriage, Baylor University Press. Thank you, Professor Paul.
Glad to be here, Mark. Thank you for having me.